federal government has taken over. You know, there was one time I threw out the term there's been a CIA coup. It's a secret government. We don't know what they do. The Congress doesn't know what they do. They rig elections. They start wars. And they have a lot of power. And even now, 70-80% of the American people believe that possibly, you know, the CIA was involved in the murder of Kennedy.
Buckle your seatbelt. It's time for another episode of the Prepper Recon Podcast.
Whether your plan is to bug out or bug in, CampingSurvival.com has all of your preparedness needs, including fish antibiotics, long-term storage food, water filters, bug-out bags, and first aid kits. Use coupon code PREPPERRECON for 5% off your entire order at CampingSurvival.com.
When disaster strikes, it's too late to prepare. PrepperRecon.com offers MOLLE-compatible individual first aid kits for your home, auto, or bug-out bag. These kits have everything you need to address a traumatic injury, including an Israeli battle dressing, quick clot, EMT shears, suture kit, Steri-Strips, tourniquet, ACS chest seal, tough strip bandages, gauze, and so much more. $89 includes shipping. To buy your individual first aid kit, go to PrepperRecon.com and click the store tab at the top of the homepage. Order today before it's too late.
Hey, Preppers and Patriots. This is the second half of my interview with John Rubino of DollarCollapse.com. Enjoy the show. Back to the commodity story. Didn't we see a big pullback in commodities right before the 08 crash?
Oh, we did. Yeah, commodities tanked back then. Oil went from, what, $140 a barrel down into the $20, $30, $40 range. And everything else followed. So there was a huge commodities crash, which also sucked precious metals down. You know, the miners got incredibly cheap for about 6 months in 2008. And then they spiked and just kept on going. And so we're seeing a world that's fairly similar to that, only we haven't seen the stock market crash that went along with it. And so if equities tank, then that gives us another year probably of weak commodities prices, because that's extremely deflationary in its own right, equities tanking. And so we could see 2008 next year rather than thinking that we're living through it right now. And so there's a lot of turmoil out there. And there's no real way to look at any historical period, even 2008, 2009, and say, well, this is it all over again. You know, as the old saying goes, history doesn't repeat, it rhymes. So there's a lot of similarities. You know, it sounds the same and looks the same in a lot of ways, but it isn't the same. And so we could see a lot of the details differ greatly from 2008, 2009. But I tend to think that, you know, in the broad sweep of things, whether everything happens in the same sequence or not, the general event is going to be similar enough that we'll look back on 2008, 2009, and 2016, 2017 as kind of similar events, except the second one is going to be much bigger than the first one.
And so orders of magnitude bigger?
Well, anything is possible with $250 billion of derivative exposure out there. So we could see some truly hair-raising worst-case scenarios from the financial system as it's currently set up. And there's no way to know whether we get something bad or very bad or off the charts horrendous from what's coming. But I think bad is at least baked in the cake. You know, we'll see hard times over the next few years just because we borrowed way too much money. You know, you don't have to really get into any kind of technical or ideological issues when common sense, don't borrow too much money or you get into trouble, is so obvious right now. You know, you just apply basic family finances, common sense, to what you see happening in the big systems of the world, and you can pretty much guarantee that there's going to be problems. And so that's guaranteed. You know, that's baked into the cake. And the question is, do we make mistakes when the bad comes that leads to incredibly bad? And I would argue that governments, as they're currently run, are pretty much guaranteed to make some serious mistakes. You know, they are going, instead of letting it play out, letting the bad debt just liquidate, and reset the system at a less indebted, more sustainable level, they're going to come in and manipulate everything in sight. They're going to cut interest rates to negative levels, and they're going to actively intervene in the stock market and try to prop up prices. And they're going to distort every imaginable price signal in what's left of the markets. And then it's very possible that the system just spins out of control, because we aren't creating enough wealth with all this malinvestment that we're doing to pay our bills going forward. And then you get mass defaults and things that the government just can't fix. And if the government tries to fix it by creating huge amounts of new currency and then buying up everything in sight to bail out all the sectors that are failing, then you get a currency crisis where people realize that, oh my God, the money supply went up by 35% this year. Why would I hold this currency when the government is creating so much more of it? And then you get the Austrian economics crack-up boom, where everybody just dumps their currency by buying real stuff whenever they get paid. And the prices then kind of hyperinflate. You know, it's not a it's not because the government is creating astronomical amounts of new currency as much as people have just lost faith in the currency. They don't want to hold it anymore. So you get a catastrophic failure of confidence. And that manifests as hyperinflation, but it's really a crash in confidence. And so that could happen if governments overreact to the next crisis. I'm frankly surprised it hasn't happened yet, but it's one possible scenario when things really spin out of control in the next few years.
And you mentioned a bond bubble. Can Janet Yellen continue to dodge subpoenas and keep rates at zero? Is she above the law and immune to market forces, or do investors have the final say?
Well, eventually the markets will win out. You know, logic and fundamentals will apply to these markets as well as everything else. But the governments of the world have been able to get away with this for a really long time. You know, if you went back 20 years and took the average economist and said, well, could the U.S. run $1.5 trillion annual deficits and then push interest rates down to zero? And then could Swiss and German rates go negative all the way out to 8 or 10 years on the yield curve and the system hold together? Is that possible? And the most economists would say, no, that'll never happen, because the system will fall apart before we get to that point. Well, we've gotten to that point. And so if we can get to crazy, who's to say we can't get to even crazier, you know, that the Fed doesn't get away with even more really dysfunctional, really bad policy. And so I don't know. You know, I don't know what the end game here is or when it happens. But the history of bubbles teaches us that they go on longer than you think they're going to be able to, and then they burst more catastrophically than anyone expected. So if, you know, James Turk and I, in the last book that we co-wrote called The Money Bubble, that's what we call the bubble that we're blowing up right now, which is a bubble in fiat currencies and government bonds. So this bubble, because it's global, has been able to expand to levels that the tech stock bubble and the housing bubble and the junk bond bubble couldn't expand to. You know, those were sector bubbles. This is global. And because of that, we know in retrospect that, you know, it was able to expand to levels that, that seemed crazy 20 years ago and seemed absolutely flat out impossible, total violations of economic law, you know, and it's still going. So I don't know where the end is, but if it's a bubble like other bubbles, just bigger in size, then it will eventually pop. And the bursting of this bubble will be more catastrophic than almost anyone expects. And that makes sense, because these are our currencies. You know, this is the money that we're carrying around. It's not like, oh, I didn't own very many junk bonds, so when that bubble bursts, not that big of a deal. You know, I'll get by, even if my overall stocks are down. But this is the money in your pocket. These are the bonds of the government that you pay taxes to and that you're on the hook for. So when the money bubble bursts, everybody is affected by it. And if everybody is affected by it, what does that do to the psychology of the global marketplace? And that's when it gets really interesting, because if you see everybody get pessimistic at the same time, then where's the bottom? You know, how do you get out of something where everybody around the world stops trusting the big systems that they used to depend on? So I don't know what happens then. And I don't know if it's a Mad Max scenario or if it's a bad financial crisis that doesn't affect the food supply chain and power generation. But either way, your money is at risk and your financial survival is really tenuous unless you take steps to protect yourself from the bursting of this bubble whenever it does burst.
And since you have such a great track record with housing, where do you see the real estate market going from here?
Well, we don't have a bubble in the U.S. like we had in 2004, 2005, 2006. But we've got, you know, we've got some froth now in a lot of places, like Miami, for instance. You know, you're well versed in South Florida real estate. I think, you know, it's really booming now, and the West Coast of the U.S. is by pretty much any definition bubbly right now, and because real estate is a leveraged asset, it's highly vulnerable to fluctuations in interest rates and the financial markets in general. You know, you let interest rates spike, for instance, and so mortgage rates go up, and you would see the air come out of the bubbles in the various regional bubbles in real estate in the U.S. And that would cause defaults and make people feel poorer, and you'd get a wealth effect in reverse there too. You know, where people feeling poorer don't want to invest in stocks, don't want to take nice vacations, and it slows the economy down. So that could easily happen. But it's not the epicenter this time. You know, the epicenter this time is financial assets like government bonds and fiat currencies. And, of course, derivatives, which just, you know, nobody understands derivatives. But if you just look at the numbers and you look at what happened in 2008 when one insurance company, AIG, had enough derivatives to blow up the entire financial market. And you realize that we've actually increased the amount of derivatives in the system since then. We didn't learn our lesson and scale back bank derivatives exposure. We allowed them to run wild. And now there's something like $250 billion of derivatives exposure out there in notional value, which dwarfs the global economy. You know, so that could blow up. Or, you know, a real estate downturn could lead to a derivatives crisis. You know, there are all kinds of intertwining aspects to this, where one thing causes another thing, which causes some really huge thing way over here. And we can't know how that's going to play out either. You know, it's like Jim Rickard's analogy of a mountainside that's covered with snow and it's pretty much ready for an avalanche, but you can't know when the snowflake that causes the avalanche will hit. You can't know what the snowflake will look like. You can't know when it's going to hit. And the snowflake itself is in no way remarkable. It just hits at just the right time that causes an avalanche. And so whatever the catalyst is for the bursting of the money bubble, there are many candidates, and we can't know which one it will be, and we can't know when it'll hit. And when it does hit, it won't be that remarkable, very probably. You know, it'll be something that a normal society would be able to tolerate just fine, but an incredibly highly leveraged society won't be able to manage. And again, that's coming. We can't know when, but that snowflake is out there. It's either in the cloud or it's on the way down or it's just hitting right now, you know?
It's time for a quick break and we'll be right back. The dollar's lost over 90% of its purchasing power since 1971. Silver, on the other hand, has proved to be a very stable form of wealth preservation over the years. And where do you buy silver? Silver.com, of course. Silver.com offers fantastic prices on silver and gold.
And you mentioned the derivatives and AIG. And I think a lot of people don't really worry about derivatives because they think that, oh, well, it's a zero-sum thing. So there's always there's for every positive position, there's a negative position and vice versa. But that wasn't really the case with AIG, right? I mean, it was based on risk models and they're writing out a lot more basically insurance policies than what they have money to back it up, because according to their risk models, they would never have to pay out more than what they have. And so they can. Basically, write checks that there's no money to cash. Is that sort of how that works?
Well, no, for every buyer, there's a seller in the derivatives market. But they aren't all equally financially stable. So what the big banks do is they write massive amounts of derivatives in both directions, long and short, in any given instrument. But then they add them all up and they net them out. So if they've got, you know, $1 trillion of long interest rate derivatives and $1 trillion of short interest rate derivatives, they say, well, they cancel out, so we have zero interest rate derivatives exposure. What that misses is that the counterparties, the guys on the other side of these contracts, have to be able to make good on them, or else your net exposure becomes your gross exposure. In other words, your gross becomes your net. In other words, you're on the hook for the whole thing if the guy on the other side goes bankrupt. And that's what happened in 2008, 2009. A lot of the counterparties, a lot of people who owed on derivatives that went wrong, couldn't pay. And that meant the big banks on the other side had all of a sudden these liabilities that they hadn't told anybody about and nobody expected to see come up and turn out to be hundreds of billions of dollars or even trillions of dollars. And so that's what we've doubled in size in the last 5 or 6 years, you know, and we made an even bigger mess by allowing the big banks to increase their derivatives books. So now what you get is the potential for somebody out there, some big hedge fund that has a lot of derivatives, for instance, to fail for a different reason. Maybe they make some other bet. Maybe they bet on oil. Okay, and oil goes down. So now they're going bankrupt. They're failing. And their interest rate derivatives are also going to be defaulted on because they're going to default on everything. So now if you're a big bank that has all these interest rate derivatives that you thought were hedged because of this hedge fund out there, and the hedge fund disappears, you're in trouble. You have to report a gigantic loss. And then everybody starts looking around saying, well, who else has this kind of exposure out there? And it turns out everybody does. So all of a sudden, everybody's selling the bank stock. The bank stocks are tanking. And that's causing the hedge funds that went long the bank stocks to fail. And so all their derivatives also fail. And so you get this cascade failure of the financial system in that way. And it started because one hedge fund blew up. So then you get the government intervening and saying, look, we'll take care of it. Here's $50 trillion, you know, just don't worry. We got your back with everything. And then the excitement shifts to the currency markets where everybody says, whoa, the Fed just guaranteed $50 trillion worth of derivatives. They're blowing up out there. Do we want to hold the currency of a country that's doing something like that? And then you get a currency crisis. So that's one scenario. And it's not an unlikely scenario at all because there are so many hedge funds out there and so many big banks and so many insurance companies and who knows who else that are loaded up on derivatives that at the same time they're taking other risks, which might come back to bite them and then might impact their derivatives. So, yeah, you know, it's a crazy world and very few people get this, even on the level that I just explained it, which is a very simplistic level. And the average person, I think, goes through their life without ever thinking about this. You know, you go to your job, you hang out with your family, you wash the car, you go to sleep, you do it all again. And you don't really obsess about derivatives or bank leverage or currency crises. That's not the way a normal person thinks. So they're blindsided by this when it happens. You know, the 2008-2009 thing came out of the blue for the average person. And the next one will too. So we'll see mass panic, largely because of a lack of understanding of why things are happening and exactly what they mean.
Well, John, now that you've scared everybody to death, what are some effective strategies that folks can take to sort of try to hedge themselves for this? And let's maybe talk about the guy that's got a 401k. What can he do?
Well, you want to distance yourself from the kinds of financial assets that are most at risk here. And that means go conservative in your 401k. You probably can't go, you know, aggressively short the stock market in a 401k. So what the next best thing is to go to short-term income funds. They won't pay you much, but they won't go down by 30 or 40% in the next bear market in stocks. And, bonds are a tougher one. You know, you've got in your 401k stocks and bonds, and it's possible that in the next crisis, long-term bonds are actually okay, and they're actually an all right place to be. But that's harder to know. But stocks, you definitely want to lessen your exposure to. And you want to increase your exposure. You probably have to do this outside of your 401k to the assets that will tend to do well in the end game here. You know, when we have that currency crisis, when the governments of the world respond to a stock market and a bond market and commodities crisis and a derivatives crisis by printing too much currency, you want to be in stuff that tends to do well when that scenario finally plays out. And that would be precious metals and really well-chosen farmland and possibly rental properties that you don't have to leverage yourself too highly to buy, but that generate free cash flow and things like that. And at the same time, that's your finance. It's finance side of your life. And at the same time, you want to become more self-sufficient. You know, don't rely on expensive stuff shipped in from far away. If you've got a little bit of land, grow a garden, you know, be able to manage your own food supply and put some solar panels on your roof so you can, if you need to, go partially off grid. And at work, don't just show up and do your job and then go home because you'll be one of the first ones laid off. Make yourself indispensable. Figure out what it is that the people who make the decisions about who works there need. Figure out what they need and then train yourself to do it and then do it on your own initiative. You know, be somebody that they turn to when they need help. And then you'll be one of the last people to go if there's some kind of a financial crisis. And so, you know, it's possible you come through this with a steady job, healthy food from the garden, relatively cheap electricity from your solar panels, and improving finances from your gold and silver. And that's the ideal scenario. And so you want to set up your life so that you're as close as possible to living that life when the time comes.
And after seeing the queues for empty ATMs in Greece, does it make sense to keep a little cash around the house?
Yeah, because even if you don't trust the U.S. dollar, you still need to transact. And right now, that's mostly the way that we transact. You know, you can't buy things for gold coins yet. And Bitcoin, which is an alternative to fiat currencies, and Bitcoin and other kinds of cryptocurrencies, are still a little bit technically beyond the reach of the average person. That's actually changing. You know, the financial system is being revolutionized at the margins by technology. And so part of the process of distancing ourselves from financial assets will at some point for the average person be include opening an account in some kind of a non-fiat currency transaction system. You know, maybe a Bitcoin account. There are several others. There's BitGold now where you can you deposit gold with these guys and then you can spend it. You know, it becomes your savings account and your checking account. You can spend your gold and transact in it. And so you can do things like that too. But basically, for now, you do need some cash on hand. And so put it in a safe place. Don't think of it as an investment that, you know, you want to go up or down in value or anything. Think of it as how you buy groceries or how you go to a yard sale and buy some stuff that you really need. You know, that's what your cash is for. And, you know, there's always the risk, as we're seeing around the world now, that in a crisis, our banks close for a while. We saw it in Greece. We saw it in Cyprus. And if you assume that we're heading down that same road, that we're going to have a financial crisis that potentially leads to capital controls or bank closures for a while or wealth confiscations, you know, the really crazy stuff that you see in other countries, but haven't happened here yet. You know, if we're afraid those things are going to happen here, then you also want some cash. Store it in a safe place that you can get to, that nobody else knows about, that you can use if, you know, for instance, if you're in Greece and the banks closed for 2 or 3 weeks and you didn't have cash, how do you pay your bills? Well, the answer is you couldn't. So you put away some cash that in the extreme circumstance of us going the way of Greece and closing our banks for a while, that you have cash. You can keep on paying your bills. You can feed your family. You can buy the other stuff that you need. You know, you can buy gas for your car to get to work. And so you're covered in that way.
And You were just talking about BitGold. Texas is kind of doing something like that. They're opening up a gold depository bank.
Well, Texas is doing it at the state level. They were storing the gold that is part of their reserves in New York. And so they've decided to bring it back home to Texas. And, you know, part of that is a political statement, and part of it is just common sense. You know, anybody who would trust the U.S. Federal Reserve with its gold is asking for the same kind of trouble Germany just had lately here, where they asked for their gold back, and the Fed basically said, no, sorry, it's going to take years for us to get it back here. And the reason for that is, the probable reason is that the gold isn't available. And Germany thought they had it sitting in a vault with their name on it, you know, and it turns out they didn't. So Texas doesn't want to be in that same situation. And you yourself shouldn't want to be in that situation, you know. That's why you hold precious metals at home, not in an account somewhere else. That's, you know, like a GLD ETF, which is a proxy for gold, but you don't actually own the gold that's in there. So that's sort of analogous to trusting the Fed to hold your gold for you. You know, you want to hold it yourself where you can see it and where you know where it is and a couple members of your family know where it is, and that's it. And so Texas is sort of doing that at a state level. You know, they're making that same decision to get their gold, which they view as one of the bases of their monetary wealth, and bring it back where they can keep track of it. So we should all be emulating Texas.
Let's just hope that they've got enough common sense to not start trying to price their oil in gold. Jade Helm might really turn out to be a completely different thing, and they might learn the same lesson that Saddam and Gaddafi learned.
Yeah, we don't want to. Texas doesn't want to become the Middle East.
No. And John, tell us one more time about your latest book that you wrote with James Turk.
It's called The Money Bubble. It's available on Amazon.com, and it covers a lot of the stuff that you and I just talked about here, Mark. And it's also available on my website, dollarclaps.com.
Great. And then you post a lot of you post your own articles, and then you link to a lot of great stuff on dollarclaps.com. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a kind of a blog / news aggregation site where I try to bring together the stories that I would normally read and post links to them so that you can see the same thing. So the idea is that you visit there once or twice a day and you're pretty much up to speed with the whole dark side of the financial world.
Very cool. Thanks so much for taking time to come back on the show.
Thanks, Mark. Enjoyed it.
In the Days of Noah, Book 2. Persecution by best-selling author Mark Goodwin. A globalist conspiracy transpires by way of a false flag attack against America's energy infrastructure. Noah and Cassandra Parker witness a complete economic meltdown, which is intentionally triggered by the event. The assault is blamed on patriots and Christians who are rounded up into detention centers across the country. Noah and his friends must take action to prepare for the meltdown and defend against the totalitarian regime, which is gunning for their freedom and, quite possibly, their very lives. Get your copy of The Days of Noah, Book 2, Persecution for Kindle, paperback or audio edition at Amazon.com today.